in 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 15. We are 1 year away from our driver's license, Grierson.
That's very exciting.
We remind you, as always, to check out all of our work. We make lots of work. We make lots of things for you. Please find us Twitter at Grierson Leach. Also, and of course, at The New Republic, which is where our reviews go up. And of course, please subscribe to us on iTunes and SoundCloud. And on weeks other than this one, we will talk, if you put the name of a movie in your review, we will talk about the movie and review that movie and quote your exact review on this podcast. But not this week, because we are busy, busy, busy. This week, it's the start of the summer movie season, so we have plenty to go over. Does it feel like summer yet for you, Grierson?
When I write the summer movie preview with you, I think then I officially feel like, okay, It's now summer movie season, yes.
So ordinarily, Grierson, we look at the movies the week after they have come out, so everyone's had a chance to watch them. But this week, because each of us have seen the big kind of kickoff movie of summer movie season, we are going to go ahead and talk about Captain America: Civil War. We're going to talk about Captain America: Civil War. We're going to talk about Keanu. And we're going to have also kind of look, we wrote about the summer movie season on The New Republic. We will be kind of going through some of the movies we're looking forward to. So it's time to talk now about Captain America: Civil War.
Stay out of this one, please. You'll only make this worse.
You saying you'll arrest me?
There will be consequences.
Captain, you seem a little defensive.
Well, it's been a long day.
If we can't accept limitations, we're no better than bad guys.
That's not the way I see it.
Sometimes I want to punch you in your perfect teeth.
Grierson, the movie is Captain America: Civil War. It is directed by Joe Russo and Anthony Russo, and of course is part of the extended Marvel Cinematic Universe, as opposed to the DC Cinematic Murder Universe. We are talking about Captain America.
You're part of the DC Everything is Fine. Don't worry. Ben Affleck, we got him. Everything's okay.
Yes,
everything's cool.
Everything's going to be fine.
In terms of getting into this, I think it's important to, establish for listeners where we both kind of stand on the Marvel Universe. Because you are a big fan of the first Avengers movie.
And a pretty big fan of the second one, not as big, but a pretty big fan of both.
You like them quite a lot, both of them. And I like them both fine, but I think...
I'm higher on them than you are.
You are higher on them than I am, though I like them both. Though for me, if you actually had to ask me, like, what is my favorite of the Marvel movies, I would be very tempted to say The Winter Soldier, which was the second Captain America movie, which was especially funny because I didn't like the first Captain America all that much. I thought it was fine, but it felt too self-consciously old-fashioned, where I thought Winter Soldier was old-fashioned in a really good way. And now this is Civil War, sort of the continuation of Winter Soldier, and it focuses on Captain America, but finds room for essentially everybody else, except for like Thor, Thor and the Hulk, who in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, rules, you have to make up these reasons why characters who should probably be there are not there for some reason.
This is the great joke of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the TV show. It's just like, because they're all, of course, lower tier B-team actors. So no, they can't get any, Chris Hemsworth is not showing up on regular ABC television on a Wednesday night. So it's like, oh, Thor was just here. You just missed him. He just walked out the door. Sorry. Oh, Banner. Oh, yeah. I was just talking to Banner 15 minutes ago. I can't believe you guys didn't run into one another.
Yeah, everybody, all the big superheroes are like the Canadian girlfriend, essentially.
I'm curious your thoughts about this, because this is not so much a Captain America sequel, though it kind of is, as much as it really is sort of Avengers 3.
Yeah, I mean, it very much sort of builds from the, hey, Iron Man and Captain America don't get along. I wonder if that's going to be a problem later.
It's a problem.
Yeah, and in terms of just sort of laying out the plot as easily and quickly as possible, because of the governments of the world being concerned that all of these incredibly powerful superheroes have these amazing powers and there's no jurisdiction and they basically do what they want. The different countries of the world essentially come to the Avengers and say, you have to be under our rules. You have to sign these agreements where you have to work under us. And Captain America thinks that's a bad idea because he worries that if the UN essentially doesn't want to do what the Avengers want to do, then how can the Avengers do, how can they protect the Earth, essentially? Where Iron Man, played by Robert Downey Jr., which has been sort of like a, I feel like a narrative arc for Tony Stark for a couple of these movies now, where he actually really feels like we need to be legislated, we need to be corralled in certain ways, our powers are too much.
In large part, too, out of guilt, because he created Ultron, who is the villain of the second movie, and realizes perhaps we have more power than we should, and we sometimes put the world in more danger than we keep it safe from.
Right. I think that's sort of like the simplest kind of way of kind of establishing why Captain America and Iron Man kind of see this from different perspectives. And what essentially happens is that you have the other superheroes in this movie essentially aligning with either Captain America or Iron Man. And this complication comes in where the Winter Soldier returns. It looks like he has killed a bunch of people. Winter Soldier swears that he has not. Captain America believes him because, of course, they grew up together. They're friends. Captain America protects him. Iron Man and his crew want to capture him and bring him to justice. Hence, how Civil War gets started.
Now, Grierson, I guess my first question for you as we start talking about this, do you think it's fair that this is kind of an Avengers 3? And you know, one of the things I really like about Avengers, and one thing I think, while, and I'll let my own personal cat out of the bag, but don't worry, it's an audio podcast, is that I like this less than the first two Avengers movies, but still think it's fine. But one of the things I love about the first Avengers, particularly the first Avengers movie, but also the second Avengers movie, there is a sense of, like, obviously these are massive corporate enterprises. These movies have so many, not only they have this so much running on this movie, they have to set up this movie, they have to come on board with this movie. And this movie in particular, you know, like the Avengers movies, has so many characters they have to bring in, so much they have to set up. And so, like, Spider-Man is here to fight for Iron Man, but what he's really here is to set up his next movie, as is Black Panther, and as is so on. One of the things I really liked about the Avengers was there was a certain meta self-aware aspect to that, and the idea that one of the things I mentioned this in my review of the Avengers at the time, that I thought it was great to have someone like Joss Whedon, who has so much experience in like television and a large number of characters on a television series, is it felt like, okay, here's this, like the way that every ongoing television show, eventually you get a series where Pam hangs out with Stanley, or Jim hangs out with Dwight's brother or something. Like, you always get some sort of random, eventually the show goes on long enough that you put two people that ordinarily aren't associated with one another together. And one of the things I really liked about the Avengers is it really played with these archetypes of these characters. Whedon clearly deeply loved all of these characters and was really excited about being able to get them together. And there was a sense of play and fun with it that I think was, as fun as the spectacle of that movie was, to me was the best part of it. It was the fact that it was just such a sense of silliness and light and just someone having a blast with this stuff. I still think this movie is fun, but it definitely, to me, felt more dutiful. It felt more, man, we have a lot of boxes to check off in this movie. And I think in it, I'm sorry, but I'm going to do it. Even though, you know, a movie like Batman vs. Superman has to do the same thing and does it a lot less competently, a ton less competently than this movie does. I think it's very well done. I think it's very well put together. But I did start to feel like, okay, we need to get everyone into this scene because we need to set up this movie and this movie. And in the Avengers, I thought one of the brilliance of the Avengers, one of the miracle of the Avengers, was that it never really felt that way.
To answer your first question, I think it is fair to call it sort of an unofficial Avengers 3. You know, I think what's really, really difficult about talking about a movie like Civil War is that there are certain constraints that are just sort of like, well, if you complain about them at this point, what is the point? Because they're just going to be there. And the big one is there are just too many characters. There is simply too many people in this movie to, you know, in a satisfying way, have enough stuff for each of them to do. And I feel like that was very true in the second Avengers. I felt like that was sort of a problem. And even something like Ant-Man, where they have to just keep putting other people in that movie so that you know what's going on in the larger universe. That being said, I actually do like Civil War with that kind of reservation intact. I think what the Russos have done with this and the Winter Soldier is I think they have an ability to juggle really well. I agree that I think the first Avengers works better than the second one. I think part of the reason why the first Avengers works is because they're all meeting for the first time. And so there's a less amount of, well, we have to explain this now and explain this now, because they're all meeting each other. So there's less backstory. There's less collective backstory. There is such a sense when you watch these movies now that it's not enough to say, oh, I've seen Iron Man. I've seen all the Iron Man movies. I saw Ant-Man. I saw the Avengers movies. I saw the Captain America movies. I'd almost submit that you have to have seen them somewhat recently, like within the last month or so, because there is, I mean, all our memories are getting worse as we get older. But I mean, my God, there are so many things in this where you do have to draw on movies from 5, 6, 7 years ago, and not just one, but several at the same time. But I think what the Russos do is I think that they are incredibly economical in terms of how to balance things. I think that they actually work in the opposite way that Whedon does. Because as you said, Whedon has such a sense of play and fun. That's his wheelhouse. I mean, he's such a geek for that stuff and he does it so well. I mean, the Russos, you know, they come from this comedy background. They come from, you know, they made an independent film that was released by Warner Brothers initially. Then they moved to television and did stuff like Arrested Development. Then they move on to do these Captain America movies and now Civil War. And so they kind of come from it in their own way, like a television type of thing in terms of balancing a bunch of characters. I think what I like about Civil War, this is probably, I wouldn't say dutiful. I would say this is actually the darkest of the Marvel films. There's more emotional stakes. There's more of a sense that there are real consequences in terms of the individual characters and their relationships with one another. That being said, I think the movie is more 85% gee whiz, this is fun, and 15%, oh, this is kind of emotional. There's like a light smattering of like emotional resonance on this movie, which I think works just fine. For me, the thing that's a little less confident or well done in this film is a trope, which I just find in general boring in comic book movies, which is we have these powers, but what is the responsibility that comes with these powers? And there's a lot of conversation.
A lot of conversation.
For me, too much conversation about, but what is our responsibility? What should we be doing? And what is especially striking for me is that obviously that is the real world resonance or real world context for the movie, or kind of the urgency of it. And I think there is actually something to be said about that. But it's funny how this movie, whenever that comes up, I sort of think, oh, here we go again. There's going to be more of these types of debates and conversations and like that. You know,
which leads to another issue with the movie that I have, which is, it's actually another problem I kind of had with The Winter Soldier. You know, one of the issues, like, you know, the Winter Soldier is basically the reason that this conflict happens. He's the reason. He's the guy. You know, to me, it's Captain America and Iron Man and all these other characters. And we keep going back to, and listen, I know that Captain America and Bucky or Winter Soldier or whatever they're calling him now are close, and they've been close for like a long time. But I don't think that character is that interesting, and I don't think he has that cool of powers. So it feels like he gets a lot of time where, like, I wasn't like a big fan of Ant-Man, but I would have liked a lot more Ant-Man than Winter Soldier in this movie. I feel like the Winter Soldier himself is this... he's just not as interesting of a superhero, or I think he's not a superhero, but he doesn't have as interesting enough powers other than that he's just this thick dude who was close with Chris Evans, with Captain America back in the day, that I don't find his story that compelling, and I don't find Captain America's devotion to him. I know it helps raise the conflict and raise the stakes, but I really don't think he's that interesting of a character, and he's kind of at the center of everything.
See, this thing is, actually, I do like him. I agree that he is not as well drawn, maybe, as some of the other characters, but their relationship I do like. And I, for me, you know, his powers are cool enough because his power is to be awesome and, you know, smash stuff. I mean,
yeah, they need more of those in the Marvel movies. There's no question.
Yes. Yes. What if he was just really strong?
Yeah, and had a
metal.
Oh,
that's good. Yeah. That's good.
Wait. Let's give him a metal hand just to like show that he's a little bit different. Just we'll give him a metal hand.
Yeah. We stayed up all night, but it was totally worth it to come up with that. Yeah. That's enough. That works. Because what's funny is that in general, the Marvel movies have not had great villains. I would actually submit that that's a big, and I think that's where the DC comics are much, much better. I think they have much better bad guys. These movies do kind of live or die on the strength of the interplay of the right. of the superheroes. Winter Soldier, that was, for me, that character made that movie, The Winter Soldier, one of the very strong ones in the Marvel series.
Well, which brings
it- and this one does too, I have to say, because especially now, because there is a question of, he says he didn't do it, Captain America believes him, Iron Man doesn't. There's enough sort of stakes and tension in that did work for me.
Yeah, but one way or the other, it's unlikely that they're going to make the Winter Soldier the bad guy in two consecutive Captain America movies, which is another thing that a lot of people did not. I think one of the problems, I think Jon Favreau, we've talked this before, but when Jon Favreau decided he didn't want to direct any more Iron Man movies, one of the things that he said was, well, after the Avengers, the stakes for every movie is, well, are we going to save the world or are we not going to save the world?
Right.
And so one thing that's, I think, theoretically should work better about this one is this is not a, someone's trying to lift a large stretch of land high enough in the air and drop it there, it becomes a meteor and destroys all life on Earth. The stakes are a little lower on this one. And the stakes in a lot of ways are, can the Avengers be destroyed or not? But the villain, such as he is or is not, is much more human scale, which I think would mean more if I found that villain more compelling. And that's another problem with this movie. I don't find, and I don't know how much a spoiler this even is, but I don't find... the person who I think it's clear he's some.
Let's just say that the people who may be part of the villain collective. Let's just leave it at that. Maybe.
Yeah.
I actually did like. The movie's 2.5 hours long, as these all are. I would say if we're dividing this movie into thirds, I think the first third is really good. I think the second third is it gets a little bit muddled. I think the last third or so, I think it kind of regains its footing. I think it gets a lot stronger as it reaches the end. And the ending and how certain things are resolved or not resolved or revealed or not revealed, I found satisfying. Again, I didn't walk away from this movie gutted. I wasn't destroyed by the implications of everything that had happened. But I found myself very... This movie is, by definition, overstuffed. There is too much in this movie. But enough of the stuff that's too much in this movie, I liked pretty darn well.
I'll give you that. And I want to move over to one more thing. There's a very fun scene very early on where Robert Downey Jr., through the magic of movies and computer generation, you see young Robert Downey Jr. Like there's a moment where we see like the Robert Downey Jr. of Shortcuts. And I'd forgotten how much I truly loved that guy.
Yes.
But that's just a side thing. You know, we see a lot of characters we've already seen. We see Ant-Man. We see Black Widow. We see whatever Elizabeth Olsen's character's name is. We see the weird alien robot thing that Paul Bettany is. The two major characters that we meet for the first time are Chadwick Boseman's Black Panther and Tom Holland's Superman. And I will say, for a movie that already has way too many superheroes in it, I actually really liked both additions. I thought they were both really good. Black Panther is going to get his own movie later. I found that character very strong and very – I feel like that character, he's a good enough actor, and that character has a certain quiet – there's not a lot of scenes with him, but each of them has like a very clear power. They make him a very large part of the narrative in a way that I feel like if that character's not really drawn that much, but it's so well played and it's such kind of a cool character that I feel like he earns his spot – to stay in the narrative as long as he does. And then Spider-Man, who essentially has one scene, is, you know, I was frankly, after watching the same Spider-Man movie 5 times, I was excited to see a Spider-Man that was a little different. He's clearly younger. He's clearly, like, there's no notion that he looks like he is 14, which I think really works well. I actually liked both the Black Panther and the Spider-Man additions to the cast.
I like Boseman better of the two. I agree that I think he's given not just more to do, but he's sort of a substantial important part of the movie. He actually factors into kind of the overall narrative. Spider-Man does feel a little bit like Simpsons spin-off showcase.
I agree with that. I certainly agree with that. But I think the way that he's played is actually, and the way that they've kind of conceived of him, I will say I find it encouraging after the last two Spider-Man movies.
I agree, but I will say that I think it kind of plays into the point that we were sort of talking about, which is that when those characters show up, I think, Oh, right.
Here we go. There's some more
more things I have to commit to memory.
Yes,
you know, there is in that. And I think that cuts both ways because, yes, there is something fun about, hey, they hang out with Spider-Man and what's that like? And how is this character going to interact with Spider-Man? Or how is this person going to be around Spider-Man? And there is a fun to that, but there is kind of a sense because Ryan Coogler is doing Black Panther, you know, I was one of the few people who didn't like Creed.
Yes.
And even in Creed, it was the same problem I kind of had, which was I could just see the architecture of, don't worry, we're building a bridge to something else. And it makes movies feel like, oh, this thing that you're watching, and this has been written about over and over again, but I do really feel it, which is, oh, this movie you're watching, just make sure you put in your memory banks because it's going to be important for a movie you're going to be seeing in 2 years. And nothing feels as present as I would like. Everything feels like a teaser for a better movie that's coming down the road. When Civil War is just about Iron Man and Captain America and the Winter Soldier and a couple other characters, I think there is something really strong. I think the Russos move it along at a really nice pace. It also has, I believe, the same writers as Winter Soldier has. I think that team sort of knows how to do those movies. The one last thing I want to ask you,
I hope they do, because they're doing like the next four. They're doing the Infinity War Part 1, Infinity War Part 2. We still have to set that up. But yeah, so there's I think they're the house team there for a while.
Yeah. Now, again, we're not going to do spoilers, but I think everybody at this point knows that there's going to be a big fight, a big battle between everybody. Without revealing anything, what did you actually think of that battle, Will?
I liked it. I actually did like it. I like one of the... It plays with a fundamental problem with good guys fighting good guys. Like after, again, not to give too much away, but after a while, like it becomes clear the characters are like, I'm not actually trying to kill you right now. and I actually feel like that's kind of, right. I feel like that's kind of a clever way to do that. It still feels a little, you know, it feels a little, here's the money shot scene, but there are enough fun little wrinkles in it and things that are a little different that while it certainly has an obligatory, here's what you're wanting notion to it, I actually thought it was well done enough that that it didn't really bother me.
In a moment in the movie where it's supposed to be like, oh my goodness, all of these superheroes are battling each other, there's more of a wee feeling to it as opposed to a real like, oh, the humanity of what's going on.
Exactly.
And I think that's both the strength and the weakness of the movie is that there is an attempt for some emotional resonance, but deep down, the movie is just fun.
Yes, I think it's fair. Right, so I'll give it my grade. I gave it a very solid B.
I gave it a very solid B plus,
yeah, I thought
which was the grade I gave Winter Soldier as well. There's a lot of things. There are a lot of things that are very fun. Some things that we kind of can't talk about right now, but I there's a lot of fun stuff in here. And I have to say also, just as a final thing, I was really not sold on Chris Evans initially as Captain America.
Yeah, he's good.
He actually, between him and Mark Ruffalo, those who sadly is not in this movie, those are probably my two favorite actors. As much as I initially liked Robert Downey Jr., there is a part of me that kind of feels like that guy doesn't have enough to do, or he's kind of doing the same arc over and over and over again. I think he's still a very good Iron Man. He's got some funny moments, but I find myself growing more and more and gravitating more and more to Chris Evans as this series goes along.
All right. So that is the Captain America Civil War. That is, I think, the last Marvel movie. Let's pour one out. Say goodbye to the Marvel Universe. I enjoyed that. I would have thought they would have made more, but I guess they're done.
I have some bad news for you.
Ooh. All right, now it is time to talk about. Now it is time.
Are there freeze frames in podcasts? By the way?
Yeah, the credits
or the thing where the it goes black, but it circles inward on one person's eye. And they're like, yee.
No, yeah, it needs to be like the always the last shot of Police Squad, where I freeze, but everything around me keeps moving around. I guess those are now called Geico ads, now that I'm thinking about it. All right, so that was Captain America Civil War. Now we're here to talk about Keanu.
Why is your door open?
Keanu.
Keanu!
I'm sorry.
Oh,
what's up, bro?
I'm here because my place got broken into. Has anyone shady come by here?
I mean, the 17th Street Blips.
The 17th Street Blips. Okay, where are they?
17th Street.
Keanu is directed by Peter Tinsio. I believe I've said that correctly. I used to follow him on Tumblr back when he was a Tumblr dude filmmaker. Now he is. He was one of the big directors of Key and Peele, the lost, lamented Comedy Central show. And now we have Keanu, written by Jordan Peele and Alex Rubin, starring Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. It is their breakthrough, their first big screen pairing together. Though not their first non Key and Peele pairing together. They were. Did you ever watch the first season of Fargo?
I still have not. No.
Well, they appear together in that. I'm quite well, I would say, in a little bit of a different feel. But this is them together in their first big screen comedy. It is Keanu. Keanu is essentially about these two guys that live in Los Angeles. They're very good friends. One of them is happily married with a family, but feels like his wife doesn't think he's as cool or manly as he feels like he's supposed to be. And then his friend, is Key. And then Peele is his friend who is stoned all of the time and very sad that his girlfriend has just left him. Into his life comes the eponymous Keanu, who is in fact a cat, or more accurately, a kitten. I don't know the exact moment.
Sorry, I just the specificity of that was really breathtaking.
I don't know the exact moment.
A cat or a kitten, perhaps.
More specific.
Part of the feline family somewhere.
Anyway, so the cat comes into Peele's life, or whatever the name of the character is, and it turns out that cat had belonged to some gangsters, and all of a sudden, all sorts of madness ensues. Now, Grierson, I was a big Key and Peele fan. Well, you were also a big Key and Peele fan. It's fine. Like a lot of people, one of the things I always like is, you know, Key and Peele were so well versed in such short sketches. It's something I think it will actually help in this movie. To talk about this movie a little bit is, you know, the thing they did that I also found very amusing was, you know, their clips were so shareable, whether it was the funny football name sketch or the anger translator sketch or some of their ongoing bits. They were so well. I think that football name sketch has been shared. Like it's one of YouTube's like biggest clips, but there would always be a little moment at the end. They'd be like, "Hey, this is actually part of a larger show that we have. Please come watch that right. show." Because I think the show itself, the ratings were always a little okay on it, but they were so good in these short chunks that I think you can tell that a little bit here, because I think the movie is sporadically funny. I think both of them are very funny in it. And still there are times where it starts to feel strained. There are some very, very funny bits in this. My personal favorite bit is the notion where Clarence, or Smoke Dresden, or Clarence's King Cat Michael Key's character is a big George Michael fan, which starts out as kind of an easy bit, easy gimmick, but turns into something that's almost moving when he turns these guys in the, what are they called, the Blips?
Yes, because they've been kicked out of both the Bloods and the Crips, so
that's not the funniest joke in the world, but it turns, he sells these guys on George Michael being the original gangster in a way that I found very clever, and I found their reactions to it very amusing. There's some, almost moving in a way. There's some really good bits in it, but again, it is definitely a movie that feels like it has a few good ideas, but when you, not only is it stretched out to feature length, but it's attached to a nothing burger of a story. And I think ultimately it becomes too much for the movie to be able to hold up.
You know, my big problem is that the movie is built around one idea. And the idea is this. These two guys who are cousins they're both nerds. And they're both, though they are black, neither of them are tough guys in kind of the media portrayal version.
Which was a theme of the show.
That was a very common, and so they are then with these guys, the Blips, who are intentionally, stereotypically, you know, hard ass gangster, you know, guys. And so because there's this misunderstanding where the leader of the Blips, played by Method Man, thinks that they're these hardcore assassins, Key and Peele's characters have to pretend that they're those guys. And so essentially they're pretending to be black in a very kind of stereotypical gangster kind of way. That is really the focal point of 98% of the humor in this movie. I kind of got tired of it in about 20 minutes, I have to say. And there are funny bits after the first 20 minutes, but as opposed to a sketch where that can be funny for 4 or 5 minutes, I mean, again, that's essentially the anger translator. I mean, that's what's so great about that sketch. But that sketch is short. And in the movie, I found myself thinking, okay, this is great. They're playing with like these media portrayals and racial stereotypes. Okay, that's funny. Okay, so now what? And I don't think what is a really, really unfunny part with Anna Faris, which is
aggressively unfunny.
And to the point where I thought, wait, am I missing what's funny about this? Because this is so unfunny. Like, is there like a joke here I'm not picking up on? You watched Key and Peele more than I did, but my impression of Key and Peele as a show was that it was really fun and smart and silly. And though it touched on racial and social issues, it was not done in a strident kind of way. It was actually very kind of fun and playful.
And when it would go, there'd be times that it would go darker. There were a few sketches. I think there's a famous sketch about a slave auction.
Yes.
Very funny, but it's certainly that the humor in that sketch is not gentle. But generally speaking, strident is definitely not a way of.
Yeah, and I would also say that it's not necessarily, they're not sort of like throwing elbows in their humor, which is not,
which is an appeal, which is something I like.
I agree. You know, in the review, I said that they seem, when you watch them on television, they seem to be the most well-adjusted like comedians since Jerry Seinfeld, because they actually seem like pretty affable guys, even though they are kind of dealing with darker sort of issues. I kept wanting the movie to be darker. I wanted it to be less kind of funny and silly and on the surface. For an R-rated movie with a lot of swearing and a lot of violence, it doesn't actually feel, I don't want to say offensive, but it doesn't even try to really push as far as that goes. And I actually think that's a problem for a movie that's about 85 minutes when it actually gets to the closing credits. This thing almost a little too polite and genial about the film, where I think there's actually a smarter, better movie if it just dug a little deeper.
It feels better. I think it's better, but it does feel like one of, during that stretch of really bad SNL spinoff comedies, where it does. It's better than those,
right.
But it still does have that feel of, you know what? We should make a movie. Like, it feels like that should be the thing that we do after this.
Yeah.
And because of that, I think, I wonder if that leads into that idea that it does feel that it's not so much pulling punches as much as it just doesn't really feel like it has that idea, but kind of feels like that idea is enough.
This is the type of movie, it's amazing got released by a studio, I have to say, because it doesn't feel like the type of movie that mainstream Hollywood studios make anymore. It feels like it should be coming out through IFC or something like that, because there's almost like the expectation of this is a really kind of crazy out there comedy. And even though it tries to sort of do parodies of gangster films and action movies, even that I think is kind of weak in the film. It's just, there's nothing really daring or necessary about how it's done. And also, I know people will want to know this because I've actually been asked this by a couple people. Yes, the kitten is cute.
Or the cat. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Who are we to say? We don't know.
Who are we to say? But, I'm not cat god.
Awesome name for a band to call it. but a cute cat is not enough.
Yeah.
And that's, by the way, that's a great breakup song title.
This cute cat is not enough. I've had, hey, listen, you know, we've all had relationships founded on less. All right, Grierson, so what did you
give it? I gave it a C.
Yeah, I gave it a C+. I think I like it a little bit more than you. I do think the George Michael stuff is legitimately funny.
Great.
That scene in the van is, and it's so funny too, because that scene in the van that I love so much, which is of him, you know, selling George Michael on everyone in the van, is intercut with the really awful Anna Faris scene. So I just like, no, get off of this. I want to get back to the van.
See what we got here.
What the fuck is this? This my shit right here.
All right, so that is Keanu, and so that is out everywhere. Okay, now it is time for our summer movie preview. We wrote a big summer movie preview for The New Republic that went up, I believe, last week. Grierson, one of the themes that I had about our summer movie preview was this kind of notion that the summer movie season almost seems perpetual, which is to say that, you know, I remember it. Remember when people thought it was really strange, even that Avatar was being released during the holiday movie season, or Titanic was released during the holiday movie season, because they felt like these big summer movies, why would they make this big budget, big expensive thing that only that, but not have it come out in the summer? And now you have Batman vs Superman in March, or you have Deadpool in February, which is a different kind of blockbuster, but certainly. You know, it feels like now we live in the summer of summer movies.
Yeah, I think now, I mean, when Force Awakens broke from the Star Wars tradition of opening during the summer, I think even more, it was true before then, but I think that really, and the fact that it did so amazingly well, it would have done well whenever it came out, of course. But the fact that Disney was completely confident releasing it during Christmas time, I think speaks to the fact that outside of Labor Day and like Labor Day weekend and January, you're going to have movies that kind of feel like event movies almost every week now.
It's a little discouraging in a lot of ways. Like I feel bad saying that, but you know, I think Mark Harris has written about this a lot, about how at Warner Brothers, basically the guy that I think just left actually is the head of the studio. You know, he was really nothing but brand. And maybe build movies around the band. Sure, I think we have to sell those. But otherwise, you know, it gotten to the point. You know, I remember people commenting so much about how, like, they made a movie out of Battleship. Like, I always feel like for some people, that was the line that, like, we will just take anything that has a brand that you remember and make a movie out of it. Now, I know I'm talking to someone who loves Battleship.
I like so Battleship. I don't love it. I won't. It's got Rihanna in it. I don't know what your problem is.
There was a stretch when we were at Deadspin that every single time, the first comment on every review that Grierson wrote was, "Hey, well, do you like Battleship?"
It's weird that was the breaking point for some people. It was all those action movies.
So many other things that offended them more.
I didn't know how to enjoy a movie, but Battleship was the one.
So the point of this is to say that, you know, the summer movie season feels like, obviously there are a lot of big releases of big expensive movies coming out, but you're right. I think in an age where Star Wars is out in December, and there's another Star Wars movie coming out this December, the idea that the notion that we used to have, and you know, you and I have talked nostalgically about our times, our childhood love affair with Entertainment Weekly, and but the idea that the summer movie preview edition felt like, wow, here are the 15 biggest movies, and now it feels like here are 15 movies we're looking forward to that come out between the beginning of March, beginning of May, and the end of August.
If you grab your calendar, this period will be between May and late August.
Exactly. And so even with these constraints, I'm curious: is there a movie that comes out this summer? Give me a movie or two that you find yourself particularly looking forward to.
I always have to preface this by saying the following: I actually don't watch trailers, and so my enthusiasm will be based on, oh, gee, that sounds like it might be great.
Or I like that director.
Or I like that director, or those people are funny, that kind of thing. And so when we do the summer movie preview together, I will then actually sit down and watch the trailers. And that can be a very upsetting moment, because I think, oh, now I see why people are maybe discouraged about this. But this upcoming movie I was looking forward to, I know that this might segue into something that you want to talk about. I am still most looking forward to Ghostbusters. It is the movie that, to me, I was joking with a friend and colleague over the last few days, who's a woman, and she was saying, like, she's kind of said in jest, like, well, if this movie doesn't do well, we're screwed, meaning women are just screwed. And it's funny, and I wrote about this for the New Republic preview. You know, 5 years ago, Bridesmaids comes out. And I always bring this up because I think people have forgotten, and I don't want people to forget this. When Bridesmaids came out, there was serious, like, furrowed brow conversations about, well, will America see a movie with funny women in it? Is this going to be, like, will it be, could it possibly be successful? And it turned out that yes, people will see females being funny in a movie. But 5 years later, the movie I'm most looking forward to this summer is Ghostbusters. And my friend's comment, I think, is actually pretty valid because there is, I think, because of the way people have responded or the way certain people have responded to the trailer, that there is a sense of if this movie is either A, bad, or even worse, B, doesn't make money, that there is going to be a sense of, okay, shut this down. Never mind. Maybe we were all too fast on this idea that women can top line a movie and it can be a bunch of women top lining a movie. So in some ways, I'm the one I'm most looking forward to, but I do have anxiety about it.
Well, yeah, it was funny because, one of the things that you and I were talking about coming in before we started the podcast was there was this report by Mike Sampson in the Screen Crush who noted and pointed out that the Ghostbusters trailer is, in fact, the most disliked movie trailer in YouTube history. And by disliked, I mean literally people turning the thumbs down button. Now, generally speaking, and I will continue this, it's never a good idea to go read the comments on anything, especially YouTube videos.
Yes.
But it is worth noting that the reason for this appears to be a sort of an MRA, men's rights kind of like, why, I ruined Grierson's computer forever by sending him the famous, from a year ago, Donald Trump getting really angry that there was we were all women in Ghostbusters, which at the time I was like, wow, how completely random. Why does Donald Trump care about this? And now a year later, I'm like, I'm fully aware that there are human beings that are pissed off that wins an all-women Ghostbusters movie. So you learn new things about the planet you walk around in every day, don't you?
They're remaking Indiana Jones without Harrison Ford. You can't do that. And now they're making Ghostbusters with only women. What's going on?
Yeah, we'll get what's coming to us if that happens to us. So I'm also looking. So, but I just think you're right. Like, it's strange how there are stakes to that movie that no movie at all, let alone some silly fun summer movie, should have to live up to.
So, what about you? So for you though, what movie are you most?
Well, first, I mean, obviously, it's Cafe Society, which is a new Woody Allen movie that I had to fight to get Grierson even in our top 15 movies, which makes me feel like a part of Grierson. The Tim Grierson I knew and loved has died. The fact that I even had to talk him in to getting the new Woody Allen movie into our top 15. Well, you'll see it, and you'll see it in Cannes, like lickety-split, right?
Yes, that is the opening film. And, of course, the last time he had the opening film was Midnight in Paris.
Yes.
So maybe it'll be...
And as I mentioned in my piece for, because I wrote up, of course, the Cafe Society bit, because we split byline the piece, we each one wrote different ones. It is worth noting that it's generally every three movies at this point. Like, because basically it's funny because Cafe Society is not actually a movie I was going to talk about, but hell, I'm here, so I might as well keep going. But one of the things that's funny about Woody Allen, and one of the things I personally as a fan find myself frustrated by, is whenever he makes a movie that lacks the energy of some of, because one of the things I love about Woody Allen is I feel like you can tell pretty quickly, oh, he's bringing it on this one. And I love Midnight in Paris, and one of the things I really love about it is it's very clear whether you like Woody Allen, I like Midnight in Paris more than most people do, more than you do certainly, but it's very clear, oh, he's bringing it in this one. And then sometimes, whereas you get like 15 minutes into Rome with Love, and I think that movie's fine, but it's obvious he's not like, oh, I'm nailing it this time. Like, every once in a while, there's a whatever works where he's like, all right, I just need to make a movie this year. And so I think when he makes a couple in a row that are just kind of feel obligatory, like I think he has in the last two with Irrational Man and especially Magic in the Moonlight, I think people are like, oh, here we go again. And they forget that it was just three movies ago that was Blue Jasmine. It was just two movies before that, which was Midnight in Paris. Or it was just three movies before that, that was Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Or two movies before that, that was Match Point. Movies that everybody loved. So,
yeah, there's a certain expectation, I think, collectively – from people of, well, we assume this movie is not going to be good, so we'll be surprised if it ends up being good. And so because of that, when he has a good movie, and then the next one maybe is not so great, there's sort of a, well, we're not really surprised, because the anomalies now, it seems to be, are the ones that are good. And also the rule we always have to remember with Woody Allen movies, as he has said, when he thinks the movie is good, he will try a little harder when it comes to its title. And I would say the Cafe Society actually sounds like a title that you actually had to think about and perhaps be happy with your movie, whereas, say, anything else and whatever works might lead someone to think, oh, he's not too happy with those movies.
What would, so, about the title, whatever works, you think it was not that well thought out?
Emoticon shrug.
Yes. Anyway, apparently there are other summer movies than Ghostbusters and the Woody Allen movie coming out this summer. But those are the two that we chose to talk about in our summer movie preview. Other movies that we mentioned in our preview, just to get them out of the way. The Lobster, which we'll actually be reviewing next week, which we'll talk about in just a second. The Nice Guys. Wiener, which is a documentary about Anthony Wiener. X-Men Apocalypse, because we're big. Generally speaking, the X-Men movies, when directed by Bryan Singer, are good, and when directed by anyone else, are bad. That's a fair assessment, yes?
Yeah, that's, I think that's,
unless you're going to count that Wolverine movie as one. Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping, which is a terrific title. I am very excited about that movie.
I'm very excited about that one as well, yes.
And then also on our list were Finding Dory. I actually watched Finding Nemo with my children today. Actually, I know there's a time where I'm going to take them to see Finding Dory, so I wanted them to have the background of Finding Nemo. And bless my son's heart, he said, yeah, but what's the score of the Cardinals game? I wanted to watch that. So, you know, apparently, sorry, Andrew Stanton, you're not trying hard enough to see the Cardinals lose their fourth in a row. The Neon Demon, which is Nicholas Winding's reference, new movie, and is not a sequel to Only God Forgives, thank God.
I like Only God Forgives.
I know you do, Tim, and I pat you on the head. The BFG, Steven Spielberg, not only Steven Spielberg, but the late Melissa Matheson, her last screenplay, and of course the screenwriter for E.T., that is coming out. We were excited about that one. Then we, of course, Ghostbusters, Jason Bourne, which is a movie that I was going to get into. I'm not going to now. And then half out of The Founder, which is Michael Keaton's next big Oscar movie, playing Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's. Sausage Party, which is Stoned Vegetables, I think.
the alternate title, Stoned Vegetables. Yes. Stoned Vegetables. If you take your kids to see Finding Dory, you and your adult friends will go see, yes, Sausage Party on,
yeah,
their own.
We need to drop the kids off at a kids animated movie, but then go and see an R-rated animated, right, movie ourselves. And of course, Suicide Squad, which to me is it's either going to be amazing or Batman vs Superman again, and I kind
of
can't
wait. It's the roll of the dice, I think, of the movies that we mentioned. I think it's the most like, yes, well, we'll just see.
Yeah. All right, Chris, so that wraps us up for episode 15. Now, one of the things we're going to start doing now is letting you know, because we had no reboot section this week. But anyway, we are going to start talking, we are going to start announcing the name of our reboot movie or movies so that you can watch them if you feel so inclined during the week and then listen to us talking about the podcast. So next week's podcast, Grierson, you are going to be about to leave for France.
That's true. That's true.
That's
true. Yes.
That's right. Good. Yes. I want to make sure you just,
I was double checking. That matches with my calendar, yes.
Yes. You looked at your map. You're like, yep, that's where that film festival it is. You will be at the Cannes Film Festival in Cannes, in the Port de Charlie. That's what that's called, Gerson, if you know that. It's not. I'm just making up French-sounding words. I've never been to France. Actually, I have. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We're going to be We're going to be previewing the Cannes Film Festival, but also our two reboot movies. So you should watch these two reboot movies if you want to follow along to our conversation next week. We're going to be talking about Married to the Mob, which was Jonathan Demme's movie from, I believe, 1989 or 1988. And we're going to be talking about Casino Royale, the reboot, if you will. There's another word for reboot other than just the name of our section on our podcast. The reboot of James Bond with Daniel Craig, the first Daniel Craig James Bond movie, Casino Royale. So we're going to be talking next week about previewing the Cannes Film Festival with Grierson and talking about Married to the Mob and Casino Royale. So are you ready for all that, Grierson? Are you going to be psyched? Are you going to be pumped? Need some time to rest up for the next podcast? Anyway, all right, Grierson. We'll be back with you and everybody else next week on the Grierson Leach podcast. As always, please follow us at Grierson Leach on Twitter and see our reviews at The New Republic. Email us at GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com. Otherwise, see you all next week. Bye, everyone.
Bye.